Welcome. My name is Bill Roberts, and my guest today on this CART.ca podcast is Tanya Williams, founder and executive director of the Real World Film Festival and the Real World Screen Institute. Tanya joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome, Tanya.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Tanya, you've done just about everything in our television and film business, from acting, producing, directing, also being an activist. You starred in The Young and the Restless, and I think that show honored you with the NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Actress in a Daytime Drama Series 2 years, 2002 and 2000 itself, I think.
Yes.
And much earlier, we sort of didn't cross paths at the Miss Black Ontario event where you were crowned, but you hosted you hosted TVO's Polka Dot Door and acted in such hits as Street Legal, Hill Street Blues, Matlock, and you did a series at Vision TV, She's the Mayor, where I happen to have done a kilted cameo appearance.
I know, and you were fantastic.
You were fantastic. No, I don't know about me. And you've had major roles of CBC, City TV, among others, many, many others. Plus, in 2012, for our podcast listeners, you received the Martin Luther King Jr. Achievement Award for your incredible film and television contributions. And that honors list just keeps on going. I mean, you received a Women in Film and Television Crystal Award in 2017. It's been a pretty incredible career, Tanya.
I know, but, you know, the fact that you can wrap it up nicely in 1 minute of my 45-year career just goes to show.
Oh, I skipped a whole bunch of things.
I know. Those are the high points. There's a lot of low points.
Well, I want to chat a bit about what were your most poignant career events in all those years? Were there any sort of life-turning, life-changing points along the way, especially I'm interested in events that are realizations that changed your perspective and perhaps even your calling as a creative person.
I think the biggest one for me was when I made the move to Los Angeles from Canada. I just found it so overwhelmingly different because the approach to the business here is, you know, it really is the whole entire town is focused on just the entertainment industry. So it doesn't matter if you have a restaurant or if you have a dry cleaners, everything is focused on that. Whereas in Toronto, I think it's more like New York, where the entertainment industry is part of many other things, but it's really serious here. So I found I started to really approach the work in a very serious way. But when I say serious, my seriousness had always been the creativity of the characters and everything. But I became schooled very quickly in the business of the entertainment industry when I moved here.
And you must have sort of evolved from that in terms of founding Real World Film Festival, now based in Toronto in 2001. Was there the connection between that change in LA and what you were doing with Real World?
I think it actually helped it because of the way I had to focus on the business, not just my creative aspect as an actor in the way that I did in Toronto, but actually learning how the networks worked, how the studios worked, because you have to understand all of that to understand your part of the cog in that.
Right.
I think that's what actually gave me the confidence and the desire to create Real World. I'm not sure I would have done that if I had continued just in my bubble of character and how do you develop character and how do you approach the work. I think it was the business aspect of it in LA that had me open my eyes to the many aspects and also the many struggles that everyone has above the line and below the line in this industry. And especially if you're a Black person and if you're Indigenous or person of color, these are very different challenges, very different, I was going to say challenges again, but really it's just the difficulty of how you need to shape out how you can make some sort of career. I mean, it's one thing to have one job, but how do you lay out and try to have a career in this industry is challenging for everybody.
Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago that you were the founder back in 2001. And full disclosure, I was for a time on your board of directors at the Real World Film Festival.
I know. Fantastic. Yeah.
And some former colleagues, Terry Marcus and Joan Jenkinson, are they still on the board?
Yes. I mean, they've gone and they've come back again. So it's been wonderful. But they are definitely back on the board, which is wonderful. It's nice to have that bit of history because being around 20 years it's nice to have people who were there before and they can see the changes and help move the business forward.
Now, in a sentence, the Real World Film Festival screens films and provides professional development for Canadian racially, ethnically diverse individuals, Indigenous filmmakers, and media artists. Is that it?
Yes, that's in a nutshell. But for people who don't know what a film festival really does, from their perspective, they could think, oh, a film festival shows films and people watch it. But really, film festivals are the center of the universe for people in the entertainment industry because you have broadcasters that get involved, you have distributors that get involved, there are sponsors that get involved, there are the artists themselves. There's a whole bunch that all think of a film festival as like the oasis in the watering hole where everyone gathers. And within that, yes, you're showing films, but these filmmakers are also trying to leverage the films that are screening to garner attention for the next project they're trying to get development in. They're also trying to find distributors for the films that are actually screening at the festival. They're trying to win awards, not to feed their own egos, but because that really helps them get into other festivals and it helps them leverage other things they want to do moving forward in the industry. So a film festival, and we have professional development, meaning there are industry panels. We also have an incubator program. So we have it's called the E20, Emerging 20 program that we've had every year now since I think 2002, where 20 Black, Indigenous, people of color creators, we get over 250 submissions and 20 are chosen to help move them forward in the development process of their projects. And then there are awards, you know, that people can get at the festival. So what's wonderful is a festival really is a great nurturing ground for everyone in the industry to come together.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it was the transition was informed by your business experience in Hollywood, but was there also something that you wanted to address in terms of negative images, access to the industry itself with real
world? Absolutely. So that's just a given. Because I'm a Black person, you're born with that concept. You're born with the concept of the struggles, your parents teach you about the civil rights struggles that have happened. And every day on the news, you're seeing what it's like to be a Black person, to be an Indigenous person, and to just walk through the world, walk through the planet. I certainly had my share of racism when I was in school, from teachers themselves. I like to remember a story of a teacher in one of my, and by the way, my parents sent me to a private school. So we're talking, this was even in private schools, that there was a teacher there that was not teaching me anything at all, would have me sit at the back of the classroom and just like read comics. And my parents would always ask, what did you learn today? What did you learn today? And I'd be like, oh no, I just read my comics, and they're forking out all this money. And my mother went to speak with her, and this is a teacher. She said, well, I never want to embarrass Tanya because I know that Black children cannot learn in the way that white children can. So we're talking that those are the kind of things that your parents have to constantly be talking to you about, that the world is not the same for you. When you go for job interviews, when you apply for a mortgage, when you try to get an apartment for rent, there are going to be obstacles in your way. And so you just learn that this is the normal. Your life will always be these obstacles, and your job is to circumvent them. My parents were both successful people. My father was a lawyer, and then he became a judge, and my mother a registered nurse. So they told me not to allow these things to victimize me, that you're supposed to navigate around it. Just because the obstacle is there doesn't mean you can't achieve and that you cannot be successful. So for me, being in the industry, I think it was always frustrating for me to leave LA and I would go up to Toronto, be invited to different events in Canada, and I saw that the needle was just not moving. You know, there was so little access still, even when people thought they were giving great access. Below the line was poorly populated. And when you spoke to unions, whether it's the Directors Guild or the Writers Guild in Canada or IATSE or NABIT, which deal with a lot of below the line, they were not collecting any statistics. They refused to, in fact. I mean, they're changing right now, but for years I'm talking about they wouldn't collect statistics. So you wouldn't know how bad the representation was. So we're just starting now to slowly get them to collect these statistics, because you can't move forward and you can't make changes if you don't even know what the reality is out there. And I think the reality is pretty dark and creating Real World was to bring attention to that. Yes, we're creating opportunity for all people of color, but we're also showing the rest of Canada in what needs to be done. And I never expect that people should support putting people of color in jobs or below the line, above the line, or the content because it's a feel good or maybe the right thing you should do. It actually makes business sense. You will look at the programming coming out of the UK right now, and you will see the amazing diversity work that they've been doing, especially over the last 15 years. You see these huge stars that we never heard of before. Like Idris Elba did not just come out of a vacuum. These were things that were put in place that opened up doors and created access. And when you create that kind of access, you're not just making someone successful for your country. You're creating talent that the world wants. So that's my dream, is that we're not just trying to do some feel-good thing here. We're actually trying to give people access and create this content that the world is going to want to see. And when you put the power of that access in the hands of the ethnicity of the community that the person comes from, you also get more authentic stories. And that rolls around to what you were saying, Bill, about the stereotypes. I mean, for a long time, Indigenous people have been very upset that people have appropriated their stories and, you know, sort of created what they wanted to without really understanding the culture. And I think we have to get back to the best stories are going to be the ones told from the point of view of people who've lived the experience. You get more positive stories out of that.
We're going to talk a bit later about statistics and data, but I'd like to, you know, give me what you believe have been your major successes and how you've changed the landscape. I mean, you've described fairly well the obstacles, and some of them are just mind-boggling, to be honest. But
right.
But you know, your major successes and how you've changed the landscape so far.
Well, I'm a big baby stepper, but when you think back to 2001, when I wrote the first grants, you know, you write grants in Canada to get funding for a lot of, because we're a nonprofit, we also have a charity status, I used the word racial diversity, and you would have thought I'd said the N-word. It was, like, horrific. Like, I got a lot of grants people going, no, no, you have to put cultural diversity. You can't put racial diversity there. I mean, they just thought that just that wording was horrific, and I had to explain that racial diversity and cultural diversity are two very separate things, and that my festival is about racial diversity, not cultural, because we like to keep reminding people, you know, that just because someone is a different color than you does not mean they're a different culture than you. The culture is still Canadian. They just might happen to be Black.
Yep.
Or they happen to be Indigenous, but they're not from necessarily different cultures. So that was a big milestone. We opened that door, and what's funny is 3-4 years later after that, everyone was using the term racial diversity like it had always been around. So that was a milestone. We also spoke with, from Heritage Canada to Telefilm to CMF, and we explained, because we were in the trenches, there were things that we could sit with them and talk to them about. And there were changes that were made in how funding, how applications were put forward, who they were reaching out to. So that's been an ongoing process. It's not like it happened overnight. There'd be one small change that happened, let's say, in 2005, and then another small change in 2008, and then another one. And we're again going through another change, because people were, up until this year, for the people that were collecting some information, they were just collecting it under a basket called racial diversity.
Right.
And now we have to break that down even more. Because there's so many groups of racial diversity now, we want to know, how are Black people faring within that? How are Asian people faring within that? So we have to break it down even more. So those are some of the changes. But also the ones that really warm my heart are the people who came to the festival in 2001, 2002 with just a dream to be in the industry. And all of a sudden, by year 5 or 10 or 15, we're screening their first feature, their second feature, their fifth. Like, we've seen the progress. We've actually seen them getting work. There's a story I love. There's a executive now at Chorus. She came to Real World in 2001. Her dream was to be a music video director. And she came to that program, and she got to meet some of the music video directors there. Then she got to volunteer at one of the production companies for music video director, because she thought that was the course she was taking. And then she got her first music video was played at Real World in 2003. And then she met someone who was working with Shaw called Karen King. And she was talking to her because she wanted to make a documentary. So cut to a year later, Karen King reached out to her and said, we're not going to go forward with your documentary, but a job opening happened here and we think you'd be perfect for it. That girl went in, she got that job at Shaw, and she's moved up the ladder and now she's an executive at Chorus. And this is one of the black executives, you know, that they have there. So this is the kind of thing that I call it success story. It's always hard, and I write this in grants, when they want to know exactly what the immediate success was right after a festival. And I go, that's not really how our industry works. And you know this as well, Bill. You could make a relationship now that the fruits of the labor of that happens 10 years later.
And that's, because that has happened.
That has happened. Our industry is really based on relationships. It's not just the content. And I think that's hard to get across to some people. Like, just because you hand somebody a script, they're not going to hand you $5 million. They're not going to even hand you $1 million because they don't know who you are. So yes, you have to have a good piece of content. You have to have a script. You have to have a project that they feel passionately about. And then the next step for them is they want to get to know you. Are you someone they can trust? What are your values? You know, how do you see the world? They have to share something with you. And that is an ongoing relationship building that everyone in the industry does, no matter what section of the industry you're in.
So Tanya,
so those are some of the things that have made me feel very positive about what we're doing.
Good. And you touched upon the use of language, and you touched upon Chorus, and we're going to circle back to those, but mm-hmm. those are the successes. What are the major obstacles? What do you think really remains to be done now?
Oh, there's so much to do. Honestly, I don't even know where to start, because
top of mind.
First of all, yeah. First of all, not even thinking about racially diverse. We really have to approach the business of the entertainment industry in Canada, I think, much more aggressively. And then when I think about people of color in particular, black and indigenous and people of color, we just have to try harder than anybody else. So it's not always to focus on the director. That is an important part, but not the only part. And you can't always focus on the writer. We need to be creating, especially in the black and indigenous and people of color community, we need to be creating producers that are only producers. Currently, what's happening is, because there's so, you know, little access, you have a lot of black directors and a lot of black writers or indigenous writers or actors just making themselves producers to move their projects along. But at some point, we have to train real producers so that they can help these creatives and to do what they do. They're creatives. Leave them in that lane where they can stay artistic and create these amazing works when producers need to go out. So that's one part of it. Then I look at casting directors. I look at agents. I look at managers. There's almost no representation.
Right.
Like when you look, there's zero. I don't think there's one black casting director in all of Canada. And when I say that to anyone in Hollywood, they really think, how is that even possible? They just think that's bizarre. So all that infrastructure, because really casting directors and agents and managers, they guide talent. They are the people who help talent along. Right now, we just have talent just floundering around by themselves. There's no one really supporting them, no one really helping them, no one guiding their careers. Like when you have a great manager, that manager should be there to say, this is not the right script for you. This is not the right project we should be attaching you to. We've had a conversation about where you want to see your career in 10 years. This is not the way we get there.
Yeah.
So artists need to have those kind of people guiding, and we have no development yet in place of that. And if you want to go to Canadian Media Fund with your television series and get some sort of funding with a distributor or a broadcaster, or if you want to go to Telefilm with your film and get some sort of funding, you need to attach recognizable, bankable talent. That's just the way it works in the whole world. It doesn't work any different in Canada. And currently, we have zero black actors that are bankable because we're not building a stable of actors. The UK have a stable that the world can. In fact, I was talking to a production company recently, and they have a new show. I think it's going into its second season. And the lead of the show is a South Asian actress, which is Archie Punjab, you know, from the UK,
yeah.
Because they couldn't find a South Asian actress in Canada. So another part of this is the challenge is we're going to have to develop actors and specifically a roster that producers can go to, that distributors know are bankable, and that takes work. Hollywood knows, and I think the UK knows as well, you know, stars just aren't born. You just don't wake up and you do a project and you're a star. There's a whole bunch of work that goes around how to cultivate that. It's working in tandem with casting directors, working in tandem with managers and agents, everybody working in tandem with the studios, with the production companies. They're working together to create that star that they know is bankable for all of them.
Now you can't,
it ends up being positive.
Now, you can't do this all by yourself, Tanya. So obviously, Real World is working with others and with partners. Are you working with...
Absolutely.
You mentioned the Canadian Media Fund. What about the Fabienne Collet Foundation or the National Bank and Netflix? They've got this kind of cross-Canada partnership.
Fabienne is wonderful. And we're actually going to be working at putting our attention to Quebec, because there is really a struggle in Quebec for Black and Indigenous and people of color. So they're it's like a whole other section that needs its own work. And Fabienne and I and several other producers actually are working together in how we can make that change there. And then I'm working with actually a group of seven other creatives, Black creatives, that consist of Jennifer Holness, Clement Virgo, Damon Oliveira, Maya Bedward, I'm trying to remember them all, Floyd Kane, it's myself, it's Charles Officer, and I think I got all eight. I hope I did. And we've been championing for the last 2 months to get a Black screen office in the same way that there is an Indigenous screen office. And CMF has now come on board, and Telefilm put out a release just yesterday about their 100,000 annual commitment to the Black screen office. So, yes, definitely, there are so many different avenues and areas that we're working, and of course Real World could never do it on its own, and it is absolutely, we're working with CBC with some of these issues. I've been talking to the TAMAC, Talent Agent Managers Association, about what I was just talking about. We're trying to create a program to create more inclusion there, and we're working with the Canadian Casting Directors of Canada. You know, we're all in talks to make things work and happen, but I also know that things take time.
Right.
You know, you have to first have conversation and recognize what the issues are, and then you have to put programs together, and some of this takes a few months, and then you have to put applications and try and find people. You know, a lot of people who don't understand what is an agent, what is a manager, you know, what are these things, you have to almost put them through a bit of a tutorial about that first, because you don't want to lose that opportunity. You wouldn't want someone to apprentice as a casting director when really their dream is to be an actor.
Let's pull back just
because that's just
going to
make them miserable.
Let's pull back just a little bit for the listeners. Can you distinguish a bit between Real World Film Festival and the Real World Screen Institute?
Absolutely. So our festival is a nonprofit and our Screen Institute is the charity arm. And the real differences are both arms are working to create inclusion, create more diversity within the entertainment industry. But our institute does things outside of the festival. So one of our projects is Access Real World, which is a national database that we launched 7 weeks ago for Black, Indigenous, and people of color in the screen industries and the creative industries in Canada. And that's just taken off. And that is not connected to Real World Film Festival. That is Real World Screen Institute. And the release is not going to come out for about a couple of weeks, but I can at least say this. We've just done a partnership with Bell Media for a program that is going to be specific in creative producers. As I said, that's been a passion, and I really want that to happen. So there is going to be a release coming out in a couple of weeks with more details about that. But it's something, once again, as I said, we need producers, and they've come on board to partner with creating something that's going to be very specific for Black, Indigenous, and people of color around television creative producers. So I'm excited about that.
So let's just...
But yeah, wherever. We're working with BC Creates right now. Because they want to expand our database to include a lot of the unions. They have a lot of work from Hollywood coming up to Vancouver, and Access Real World is the database that they're going to be promoting to Hollywood, so that, because Hollywood is now demanding that, where are your Black and Indigenous and people of color? We want to include them in our hiring practices.
Now, Access Real World is a national database. It's a job board for Canadian racially diverse creators and industry professionals. And you mentioned Hollywood. So is our Canadian consulate in Hollywood involved?
Yes, we're in, actually in talks right now. We were supposed to already have done an on-site event, but that has been pushed and pushed. And now I think as of 2 weeks ago, we realized, okay, we're, on-site is not going to happen. So we're going to try and do something on the digital platform, hopefully the first week of December. But even without the and the consulate is 100% behind Access Real World, but even beyond the consulate, we have a series of things. We're going to be working with a publicist here. I say here because I live in Los Angeles, but we're going to be working with a publicist here so that they can get the word out more about hiring when they're up in Canada. We have a lot of productions that come up from the U.S., and they want to know how they can find this talent. So it's going to be all talent. And we also have the support of the unions, which was great, because a lot of times we can ask questions on Access Real World, or we can identify people in a way that they may not be as comfortable as because of privacy issues. So it's going to be easier for also the unions are supporting us. And we're using the database. This is great because BC Creates came up with this. They're adding some funding because they want to be able to collect data back end, like not personal information, but the data of who's getting jobs and how things are working. So that's another aspect that we're going to be doing with Access Real World.
Now, you just a few minutes ago alluded to a possible scoop there with regard to Bell Media developing yes. something with Real World. Is this going to be focused around producers? Is that what we're looking
yes.
at?
Yes, only producers. These are not going to be anyone who is just really trying to produce their own project, but we're looking for people that are not writers, that are not actors, that are not directors, who have a driving passion to be producers. Because I think that's a missing link that really is a missing link. And so this program with Bell Media will be around that.
And did you mentioned Telefilms Canada's pledge to support the creation of a black screen office?
Yes. They're one piece of it. CMF will be also, and additional partners, because of course we need to create a fund. We're hoping the fund will be like a $10 million fund. That's what we're aiming for. So that it'll be the Black Screen Office will have a $10 million fund, and it will do a lot of the things that the Indigenous Screen Office does, but its focus will be on the black community in terms of above the line, below the line, and even arts organizations like my organization, like Fabienne's, which is the Montreal International Black Film Festival. So it'll be also gathering information about the different organizations across Canada that are pushing for black creatives.
Okay. So in Canada, things need to happen in a policy context.
Yes.
Real World spoke to the Senate Committee on Foreign Policy and Diplomacy back in 2018. What did you tell them, and how was that received?
It was really wonderful because they were looking at the arts really as a door to diplomacy, to worldwide diplomacy. And that's been used for centuries. Artistic endeavors are wonderful things to bring people together, whether you're inviting them to a screening or to an art show or to an opera. It's beautiful diplomacy. But my part in it and why they had me speak was the importance of, because when I travel quite a bit, and I'm always surprised when I tell people I'm Canadian, and you're talking, I'm traveling in Europe and all over the place, and they're like, oh, are there a lot of black people in Canada? They always come up with that question, which I find hilarious. I go, yes, there's actually quite a few of us. But you wouldn't know that by the way Canada represents itself outside of the country. We call ourselves the most diverse country in the world, but the world doesn't seem to know it. We're not marketing that very well.
Right.
So a part of what I was saying at the committee and what they wanted to hear was we need to be rethinking how we, the pamphlets we send out and the art that we send out. All the art cannot be from white artists or just Indigenous. Like, we want the world to know there are Asian people in Canada, there are black people in Canada, there are South Asian people in Canada, there are Canadians also, and their works are not always being traveled when governments do those sort of traveling things. And that's what we wanted to talk about.
Okay.
So it was very well received. It was great. And they had brought on other organizations like Real World as well, who spoke on similar things. So it was nice that it wasn't just one voice in the wind. There were several voices sort of echoing the same thing.
Then in 2020, this year, Real World, you know, driven by your mission to eradicate racism, especially in media, you commissioned a report from Communications MDR.
Yeah, we started that last year and we got to release it March of this year. It's amazing that we were doing that report. We started working on that report like July of last, you know, the whole thing takes a while to come together with the surveys and collecting and then the research that MDR had to do, and they did a fantastic job. And then we released it right at the moment that everything was coming down, the whole George Floyd thing and the sort of the focus on anti-Black racism in particular, and then the, sort of a global coalition happened, and our report. You'd think we planned it, but it really was we just happened to release the report at that moment, and everybody wanted to get their hands on it, because I'm sure if all these things had not have happened, it's not like the industry clamors, you know, for these reports, but they were clamoring for ours. And it's still up on the go to realworld.ca. And what we did is, instead of just putting it there for anybody to see, we made it that people had to sign up to get it. And the reason we did that is we want to be able to follow up in 6 months, in a year, with those people to say, did you find the report useful? Were there things you were able to execute where you work? You know, were these ideas helpful? And Ontario Creates, which was the major sponsor of that report, they were really behind that too, because normally they just put up the reports on their own websites, and they were like, no, this is great. Let's see if we can follow up with some of these people.
So it's got a fairly long title. I'll try one more time. It's called Changing the Narrative, :2020 Status of Canadian Black, Indigenous, and People of Color in Canada's Screen-Based Production Sector. So what is the status in 2020? What's the gist of that report?
I would say what was great that people got out of the report was there are a lot of well-educated, and we just did English Canada, by the way, because we want to do another report, but for French, but it was, we focused on English Canada. So a lot of people were well-educated, well-trained, and couldn't get jobs. So that was different. It wasn't that they needed more training. It's that they still don't get access, even when they are well-trained. So that was a key part of it. People were tired of anybody saying we needed more sensitivity training. They were like, we don't need any more money spent on sensitivity training. If people don't know by now, it's like they're not going to know. So let's move on. And in the report, it talks about looking at the board of directors. There's a lack of representation at the executive levels, at the leadership levels. So we're talking about, you know, board of directors and executives in government arms of the arts, whether it's the Toronto Arts Council or be, you know, all the different councils or the different funding areas from telefilm to all of them. It wasn't just a problem in one place. It was a problem everywhere. So a need to look at that and just opening the door to better networking, because a lot of us, you know, we create our networking almost from school. You know, you kind of know the people that you, like, you might have gone to drama school with, or you went to film school with, and you kind of expand from there. But if you're not already in a circle knowing people who are racially diverse, your circle might be very small. So at some point, we have to open ourselves up to the concept of we need to add more diversity to our circle, or we're never going to change, you know, going forward. So that was another key thing. And then data, you touched on that before, how key that was. We can't know what changes to make if we don't know what the numbers are. Right. It's so important. Everything is driven by data. And so we're going to have to just get down and dirty, no matter how ugly the numbers look. We just need to know what we're starting with so that we can know how can we improve this. And then we can do more data in the future and go, yes, we're on the right track. But if the numbers don't move in the future, then we'll know, well, whatever we're doing is not working.
Now
so we're only going to be able to do that.
Now, you've said you've worked with strategic partners on in getting this far. Broadcasters, you referenced unions. I think you've also worked with community centers and youth workshops. How has it gone with Canadian broadcasters?
All Canadian broadcasters are slightly different. Now, the great thing about CBC, for instance, is they are, you know, government agency with an agenda for Canadian talent. But we do have other broadcasters. They're great. Like I would say, you know, I was going to say Channel 9, but I meant CTV. And then we have Global or Chorus. And they have quite a bit of American content on their shows, on their networks, because they're competing with America and it's a much more corporate structure. And, it's hard to say, it's hard, you know, because you always want to tread, you know, you don't want to get anyone in trouble. You don't want to upset anybody. But I think I'm very nervous when I think the CRTC or the government starts opening up to other countries, particularly the U.S., having access on our airwaves, and that in the agreements, the amount of Canadian content and the hours that they can show that Canadian content may not be very favorable to Canadians. So I think as we have these conversations, change is still, you know, needing to be made there. But
well, let's dig down a bit on Chorus and Global. They've launched a systemic racism organizational review. They launched it this July, I think. And I think it was stimulated by the Canadian Association of Black Journalists. They wrote an open letter. Pretty strongly worded letter. I think one of the quotes is overt racism and a lack of representation, end of quote, at Global. And then there was about 140 plus Global employees wrote their own supportive open letter. Is this typical of what's happening in the Canadian broadcasting world, or is this a unique situation to Global?
No, I would say this is typical of what's happening on the entire planet right now. It was really, it's quite amazing. It's like George Floyd was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's like people have been having open letters and talking about this for decades, but it's like people were just so fed up. They were tired of waiting. They've heard that changes are going to happen. And, this is the kind of change I always hate though. When people are like, we're going to increase 20% that or 50% this or 40% that. Those words mean nothing to me. I mean, I want hard numbers. I want you to tell me we have 100 employees, we have 10 executives, and next year, 5 more executives are going to be black, you know, 3 executives are going to be indigenous. We have to have hard numbers now at this point, because we've heard for decades these percentage games and how things are going to improve, but they haven't improved. So, so just saying the same rhetoric is not what people wanted to hear. And so I think these more forcible letters, these angrier letters now are because people are like, we've tried the nicer letters. We've tried the nice communications. You've promised things that we understand now it never changes. So I think people are just pushing harder. But I would say the people I talk to from the UK to all, or even the Scandinavian countries, you know, there are people of color in Norway that are struggling, you know, so it's everyone is being more vocal and they're speaking up and they're not sitting back anymore. And they're saying, I want to see that change immediately. I don't want to wait 10 years for it.
Well, I'm not going to let either of us off the hook on the Chorus Global item. You know, just I think it was yesterday, actually, Vice World News ran a story that in the midst of this sort of race reckoning at Global News, the company laid off some of its most vocal internal critics, at least 8 of whom were among the 140 plus who signed on to that open letter. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, it's horrible. It really is a horrible thing. But I'm also someone that's not always the knee-jerk reactor of, they may not have been laid off just because they were vocal, because as you said, it was 8 people of the 140.
Yep. Absolutely.
I think if the 140 had been let go, I would be much more upset. But somewhere in there, some people had to be let go. And you know what? It's a terrible thing to say right now, but COVID has seriously affected the broadcast industry. All of us are affected by it. We're not working. Production is, you know, stalled, and it's just an S show out there, and everyone's just trying to survive, and cutting jobs is what's going to happen. And sometimes it's terrible, but sometimes people of color are also on the chopping block. But I would look to see if there was a consistency. If people, you know, this is what's great about data. If the data says consistently a broadcaster is only firing the black, indigenous, people of color, then you have the numbers that say it. But that one thing yesterday is not an outcry of this is just racist. And because even if they'd only fired one person, would people have been similarly upset?
Right. And there's no doubt, as you say, Tanya, that there's been a massive collapse in ad revenue due to COVID-19. I know that Chorus's revenue has been down 24% in the third quarter, so it's good of you to put it in context.
Yeah, and I'm a film festival, and I have sponsors, and I've had sponsors going, Tanya, I know we normally give you 10,000, but this year we can do two. You know, and I'm happy that they can give any, because there's some sponsors who are like, we can't even come back. We want to, especially the sponsors that have members. So if you have a DGC and your members aren't even working, like, how can you, in all honestly, like, give out money to sponsorship? So I think everyone has been hit and they're doing the best they can. I'm sure on it, like, I have to think the way Chorus would is just a business. I'm sure they were horrified they had to let go any people of color, really, because of all the attention. They probably knew there was going to be blowback, but they still had to probably look at the numbers and go, we have to cut these people.
Well, we did our due diligence, so let's move on to the next one. You've been very sensitive in this conversation about the use of language, and you haven't used the term BIPOC in your art chat today. So it's a term that is widely used. So is it inaccurate? Is it BIPOC?
Yeah, it's very specific for me and also for real world. But here's my reasoning. The word is being used a lot in Canada. I don't like to think only Canadian. I like to think about Canadian talent, but I like to think internationally too. It is not a word that's being embraced internationally. In fact, in the UK, there's a completely different acronym. In Europe, they don't know what any of these acronyms mean. So to me, to get the message across, here's what I'm nervous about. I heard someone in a panel that I was on a couple of weeks ago say, we're hiring a BIPOC person. That makes me scared. How do you hire one BIPOC person? You know,
now, perhaps you should mention what BIPOC stands for as well.
Exactly. BIPOC is not an individual. I want people to always remember you need to be hiring Black people. You need to be hiring Indigenous people. You need to be hiring Asian people. You need to be hiring South Asian people. You don't get away with, and this is what I'm worried about the word, people who don't mean to be racist, but they'll go, I hired one person. Shouldn't I be checked? I get to check the box. I'm good to go.
And BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous people of color.
Exactly. So, because remember, each one of these ethnicities has their own unique struggles. Colonialism, because it's been around for hundreds of years, has parsed that ethnicity into shadism. It's a dirty word we don't like to use. The lighter skin of any race has always been more welcome in the colonial communities, and the darker skin you were in the community of race that you were is the worse jobs, the less access you got. So it even goes back to slavery. The lighter skinned slaves were brought into the house. You got the better jobs. The darker skinned slaves, you were left in the field. You weren't allowed to be in the house. This kind of uncharted, unbiased, you know, is that bias is still, it's still niggling underneath everything we do. So when you say just BIPOC, there are a lot of people that don't know yet, even within themselves, that they may lean towards a fairer skinned person within that community. Mm-hmm. You still have to check yourself and go Black. You need a spectrum. And I said to someone, this is how I see it. You know, when you're putting a garden together, you have all kinds of different flowers. You don't just throw your seeds willy-nilly anywhere. You like cultivate colors and, you know, to make that beautiful garden. You need to be thinking about that in your hiring practices. I know it might sound crude in the beginning, but I was talking to, we just hired on a young Black guy at Real World. He's dark skinned. He has dreads. He's the most soft-spoken, lovely guy. But he's being, the doors are being closed to him the minute he happens to have a name that sounds very Scottish, by the way. So he gets these interviews, and the minute they see what he looks like, he feels it. They shut down right away. And that is because that's the negative stereotypism I'm talking about. A lot of the product, you know, the TV shows and whatever, they show people that look like him as criminals. So it's deep-seated in us. And when we use this word BIPOC, I think it lets us off the hook. I think we have to be much more conscientious. Just because you hire Black people where you are, don't think you're off the hook there either. You need to look at the Black people you're hiring. You should have a certain amount that are more fair-skinned and a certain amount that are darker-skinned. That is how deep racism can be. It's difficult. It's challenging. Everybody's looking for a quick fix, but there's not going to be a quick fix. This damage has been hundreds of years in the creating of it. It's going to take much more than a minute to solve it.
Understood.
And until we're comfortable with all the many shades of all the many races, I think we should continue to be sort of diligent in how we and how we think about race.
So a bit of the practical things, not that we haven't been talking about practical things, but I'm talking about dates here right now.
Right.
This year, the Real World Film Festival is scheduled for October 14th to 19th.
Correct.
So this is, you know, end of August, getting into September. What impact has COVID-19, the pandemic, had on those plans, those arrangements for 2020?
Okay, first of all, our festival is 100% completely different because COVID means I have no on-site festival. So pretty much all the Toronto festivals are working the same way. Toronto International has announced the same thing. So we're on a digital platform, and we've been because you're right, the festival, it's amazing. October is around the corner. We've been working since March. Since the minute I heard about the shutdown, we decided, worst scenario, we were going to be digital. In a best scenario, we knew it would be digital and on-site. So we just stopped thinking that there was going to be only an on-site festival. We just got that out of our heads. So we were planning for a partial on-site and a digital. And the digital was a whole learning curve. I mean, I am not a savvy tech person. And so I've had to learn more about screening platforms, and we're working with CineSend, and how playlists need to be uploaded, and video on demand is going to work, and the preferred suggested screening times that we're going to do to our audience. This has been a learning curve, but we've all learned quickly, and we weren't alone. In fact, there are six festivals that happen around the same time. It's myself, Inside Out, Regent Park, Planet and Focus, Imaginative, and Real Asian. And the EDs, I'm one of them, and the five other EDs of these festivals, we've been meeting every Wednesday for 1 hour. Oh. And we've been troubleshooting and talking and sharing resources. And even 2 weeks ago, we had to start thinking of what are new titles. Like titles to call people, because we've had to hire digital supervisor, you know, digital technician of whatever. They're all new staff people that we've had to bring on and hire volunteers. We don't even know how we deal with volunteers. Like, what do we really need volunteers for? So that's really sad, because a festival is kind of the buzz of people that come out and volunteers who love meeting the filmmakers and seeing the audience. We're just all trying to recreate that in a digital. So it's not going to be the same. Some things people aren't going to like as much, but other things are better. For instance, we're thinking much more national now than we were. We're not just going to be in a location in Toronto. And yes, our screenings are going to be geo-blocked to Ontario, but we're still going to reach an audience in Ontario that may not normally have driven all the way to Toronto. And then our industry panels are larger now. We're thinking about people from Quebec are going to be watching, people from Vancouver are going to be watching, and Winnipeg. So we're really thinking in a much more national way. Then it's harder to do that when you're in one on-site situation. So for me, I feel like even going forward, even if we go back to some on-site, we'll always continue with some digital aspect of the festival now.
And the Screen
Institute too.
And what about the impact on you personally? I mean, the festival is in Toronto. Its physical presence is in Toronto. The office is in Toronto. But this podcast, this CART.ca podcast, has you in Los Angeles. And
so for 20 years, this is how I've been doing Real World. So people might have thought I was sitting in Toronto, but I was in Los Angeles. I would fly up for certain things. I would be there physically for the festival. But my home has been Los Angeles since 1987. And I started the festival in 2001, so my home has been here. It's been an adjustment for the staff. They're working from home, but I'm like, this is how I've always worked. My schedule is I get up at 5 in the morning because I'm a morning person. And then I start at my computer at 6 a.m., which is 9 a.m. in Toronto. And then I work intensely, you know, until 2 p.m. my time, which is 5 o'clock Toronto. And then I kind of take my break. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon for me. But then I kind of think about, you know, what kind of things I want to do the next day, what I want the staff to do, what I want our focus to do. But this kind of schedule is what I've been doing for 20 years. It's not sort of new for me. So it's felt very relaxing.
All right. All right. So money. Let's talk about money for a second. You've got
my favorite subject, by the way.
You've got some pretty significant sponsors. You've got platinum partners like TD Bank, Telefilm Canada, Cineplex. You've got government sponsors, premium sponsors, industry, community partners. Are you getting the sense yourself and real world that the money talks part of our business is now really getting on side in some kind of a permanent way with diversity and inclusivity and a change for the better?
Well, you know what? I hope it does, but I am a cynic. I hope your guest.
You were just an optimist a few minutes ago.
Yeah, I hope your guest can sense that just in the way that I talk is I always hope for the best, of course, but I'm always prepared for the worst. I've been in this industry too long. It's been 45 years. I know things are fashionable. Things go this way. Things go that way. We're in a moment. I'm taking advantage of the moment. I don't know what the moment will be next year. And I really think that's sort of, remember, it was only maybe last year that everything was the Me Too movement. We were totally focused on women. So now we're totally focused on Black people. Next year, we don't know what we'll be focused on. So I strike while the iron's hot. But really, a lot of our partners, they've been with us more than 15 years. So they're not in it for the short term. We've added more sponsors this year, which is great because of, but TD Bank has been with us for, I think, 14 years now. So they have always understood this was important. What's been great is a lot of sponsors that have been with us for a while, especially the corporate ones, have upped the money that they've given us. So because they always supported us, but they feel us, we are more invaluable now. So they have upped the money. I hopefully that up the money stays with us in the coming years, but I'm always preparing for if the money goes down, if the money goes up. I'm just that way. It's my survival instinct. I have a strong survival instinct. So I'm always prepared for whatever. In fact, it's funny. This week and next week, we're pre-recording, our conversations with filmmakers. Not because we don't want to have them live, but I'm already in preparation that if the live does not work, I will switch to the pre-recorded, conversations we've had with them. So I'm always about preparation. And I think, every part of the artistic world, even if you're a ballerina, even if you're a pianist, it's preparation, preparation, preparation. And that's the sort of the discipline I grew up with as a child.
Now, we talk a lot about Telefilm Canada in these last 30 minutes or so. They're a big partner of yours, and you did touch on what they're doing with data. They're looking at collecting data, self-identifying data.
Right.
Anything more you want to say about that?
Telefilm was literally the first agency that came on board back in 2001. They have been a supporter with Real World for 20 years. So I have a great relationship with them. And Krista Dickerson, who is the executive director, she's really only been there, I want to say 3 years. But it's a beast, you know, it's a beast to move. It's a government beast. And I think they're doing their best. They certainly know, none of them at Telefilm say, we're doing the best we can. You know, they're saying we have a lot of work to do, and they want it. They speak to me, and they speak to hundreds of other people across Canada who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. They are trying to address many of the issues that have come up. And what I like is I've actually not had a conversation, not just with Telefilm. I'm talking about Canadian Media Fund has been really supportive as well. They put together a Black leaders group of 20 people that are from across Canada that we've been guiding for the last 3 months in some of the areas that they should be putting more spotlight. In fact, they put a $4 million fund right now for help to help that the Black and people of color, because they already had a fund for the Indigenous together. So I feel everyone, this is an energy I've never felt before. Everyone, especially at the executive level, Catherine Tate at CBC, you know, Randy Lennox at Bell, they are saying, we want to help. Help us. What is it we can do? They are open in a way that they were probably open before, but they were really open now. And that's been really wonderful. So Telefilm has been the same way, and all these others have too. I had a great meeting myself with the Heritage Minister, and it was so, you know, beautiful to hear how he wants to know what is it, you know, we can do. There's no one saying we don't want to do that. I have not heard that yet. Those are not uttered from anyone's lips. They're like, let's try and move that. Now that we like this idea, help us with the steps. How do we create the steps to achieving this goal?
I think the thing I like about Telephone Canada's data collection is it actually is looking at ownership and control. So self-identifying with racialized persons, the LGBTQ community, persons with disabilities, Indigenous individuals, women, members of official language minorities. I think it seems that's pretty unique in our business to be looking at ownership.
It's wonderful they're doing that, but here's where we need it even more dissected. When they say women right now, we want to get that intersectionality between even within women, what is the breakdown of Black to Indigenous to, like, what is that makeup within women? Because then we'll know. How is that going? And when we say racialized diversity, once again, we don't know what that looks like. So that is the next step. We need them to break down that basket into smaller bite-sized pieces so we can get the real numbers. Because it could be deceiving. You could get a number that says, 60-something percent of racialized whatever. And when you get that down, it could be less than 1% of that are Black people.
And how would you use that data?
It would change funding. It would change how is the money being properly sort of spread out equitably among everyone, or is it really heavy to one or two races and other races aren't getting any of it? So the only way to know that is to kind of – I think that's the main thing. It's equity at the end of the day. Like is there the same amount of money? Here's a question we always want to know. When there's a television show, are the people who are white – Is the funding the same for them as other shows? Because I've heard from especially Indigenous and Black creators that they've talked to their white counterparts and they get smaller budgets to make the same show. So, of course, the quality of that show is not going to be the same. When your budget to get a weekly show out is only X amount, you know that affects how the look of the show is, how the music composition, it affects, you know, the sets you're working with. And so everything looks a little cheap and a little shoddier. So are we setting them up to fail? Data is what helps us understand that.
Good point.
If you have a show that's getting $1 million a week to produce and another show that's getting $250,000 to produce the show, it's not going to be the same show.
Tanya, we've covered a lot of ground.
That's great.
My last question for today. What questions have I actually missed or not asked? Is there one question that I should have asked that I haven't? And what message do you want to add to our CART.ca podcast listeners for their attention?
I think it's the question that is the unspoken. There is a lot of white Canada that is feeling uncomfortable right now. And I think I really hope they don't feel uncomfortable. Either they're feeling uncomfortable like, are people blaming me? You know, is it my fault? And it's not. No one's blaming anyone. In fact, some people are just venting because they've just, you know, some like Black people or Indigenous people or people of color, they're really only venting because they've had to suppress this for so long. But the venting does not mean we're blaming you for anything. And then there are white people who go, it's all unfair now. It doesn't feel fair anymore. Like they're getting special access and special attention. But I want those same people to go back and look in history. In history, it was unfair for a very long time in one direction. And it may appear it's unfair now, but I think back to the early 1600s. You know, there is the white people came to Canada and they enslaved Indigenous people, but people forget they brought Black people to Canada and enslaved them too. Indigenous people and Black people were enslaved for over 200 years. Try to imagine the wealth that built white communities. That is the kind of, deep family wealth that's built the biggest families in Canada. That kind of wealth that just never goes away was built on free labor for 200 years. And that's when there was slavery. After slavery, wasn't like things were all perfect then. After slavery, when slaves came up and tried to arrive in Toronto, they were not let off the trains. They were said, you are not welcome in our city. And that's when Chatsworth and some of those other communities built in a Black, especially in a Black community. That was unfair as well. There were internment camps. So Japanese in Canada, Indigenous people in the residential schools, there is a lot of pain and a lot of discrimination that's happened over hundreds of years. So because we are now trying to, desperately trying to level the playing field, it could feel unfair for the moment. But I ask the listeners who feel that way to delve into the history and understand the suffering that the people that we're speaking about have suffered, and the reason that they are behind in this race are because of all of that. So I would say that, yeah, that would be part of the question, the answer I would want to have people address and look at and think about.
Fair enough, Tanya. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us today from Los Angeles.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Bill Roberts for CART.ca, and I've had the pleasure of talking with Tanya Williams, an incredible, dedicated individual committed to positive change and certainly to supporting diversity and inclusive representation in Canadian media. Check out Real World at www.realworld.ca. It's been a pleasure, Tanya. Thank you, and bye for now.